It's a pleasure to have him on the program. It was a great surprise last week when I got a phone call from his representative, Danielle Alberico, who was kind enough to broker the appearance here tonight. And as I said previously, it's an almost unprecedented situation. I mean, I'm sure it's not in the history of cinema, but to have somebody producing and directing a documentary right on the heels of a production that they had had that they had produced on the same subject, getting to tackle it really from both sides, based on a true story and the literal true story. This is a very gifted filmmaker. We're very glad to have him on tonight here. Ohio State's own Tommy Reed, and we take pride in saying that here in the flagship city of the Sports Talk Network in Cleveland, Ohio. Our pleasure to have on Tommy Reed on the program tonight. Tommy, great to have you on, sir. How are you this evening? Tommy?
Thanks for having me on.
Oh, it's a pleasure to have you on. Tommy, and I'd like to just walk through this with you here, the kind of dichotomy of looking at this from both sides, as you've done with producing the Hollywood version, as I had introduced it before, in indie, but one that really didn't feel like it, especially with the cast that you had and everything that that had going for it, and then doing a documentary where you're looking at the literal story of it, no embellishments for creative effect or anything like that. What was that like looking at it from both sides within a couple of years one another?
Well, you know, it's been a long journey, and it's really now been a dream come true. So, you know, I mean, first and foremost, I wanted to get this story out there to the people of Cleveland. You know, this is their story. This is their history. And being a Buckeye, I heard all about this tale when I was in college in the late 90s. And I just never found anything because the internet was brand new, and you know, I'm kind of dating myself there. But it was kind of brand new, and there was no topics really, you know, that were on Danny Green. There were just some news articles, and that was really it. Then I found out that Rick Torrillo, through my buddy Dominic Powell, who's a Cleveland native, would always talk about this guy, Danny Green. And myself being a New Jersey native, I always heard about John Gotti and Sammy the Bull. And this Danny Green character just fascinated me. And I was just so interested to pursue more, but there wasn't really much, you know, information or research when I was doing it all on Danny Green. So when Rick's book came out, I jumped at the opportunity. I just graduated from Ohio State and just finished film school in New York City. And it was very difficult for me to, you know, tell him that it's going to take me a while. But at the end of the day, I promise you I will make you the best movie I possibly can. And 13 years later, Rick, here we are, you know, with the movie coming out this past St. Patrick's Day. It's really a dream come true. And really, the documentary comes out of frustration when I never actually got a chance to tell the movie as fast as I wanted to. After 10 years of holding on to the book rights, I'm like, man, I am so knowledgeable in this organized crime of Cleveland and this rich history that Cleveland has. I got to say something because all these people are like, starting to pass away. And Danny Green is almost like an urban legend to one extent. And so I came out to Cleveland in 2008, and I went out there. I stayed at one of the producers' house, Dr. Steve Papandreas, another Cleveland native. And these guys just opened up their doors to me and allowed me to bring in a very small skeleton crew to come out and film this documentary, Danny Green, The Rise and Fall of the Irishman, in Cleveland. And I got to actually talk to the real people. And to me, that was a dream come true as well. Just to have now in theaters the movie, and then this weekend opening up at the Atlas Theater in Euclid, the Danny Green documentary, everyone's going crazy for it. And we had 7 sold-out shows at the Cleveland International Film Festival this past week, and I'm just so fortunate to be able to tell this story and give it back to the people of Cleveland. This is your history. This is your story. I'm just really excited about it, Rick.
Well, absolutely, Tommy, and it is something. I mean, I've been a native of this city my whole life. I mean, aside from college and an internship out of town, I've lived here in the Sports Talk Network flagship city my whole life. So it really is a subject of fascination. There's 2 follow-up questions I have based on your first answer there. I'll get to the one that I want to ask about from your perspective. But I want to get to a question that you would know about as somebody who dug into the history. I'm going to ask you this one first, and that is, in terms of me explaining this to people out of town, the story and everything like that, it does seem unlikely because, again, it took you being in Ohio to actually hear of this guy. But yet, it really was a significant piece of history. If you look at La Cosa Nostra, I'm fascinated by it myself. I've read a lot on it and everything. I find it to be very entertaining as well. How did Cleveland retain this kind of significance well into the 70s? I mean, my sense of it just, you know, from a 50,000-foot view is that Cleveland, of course, you know, around mid-century and earlier actually was a very important city before it really bled population and being that pivotal point between Chicago and New York. Cleveland at one point in time really was very important, and John Scalish took over the mob here when it was really important, and that maybe he was able to kind of consolidate and keep it at that higher level. But how could Cleveland have turned into Bomb City or USA in the 1970s when everything else had really started kind of going to hell here, and yet the mob, it actually had an operation that was still worth fighting for at that point?
Well, Cleveland has such a rich history, and it goes back to, you know, when I was interviewing even Tony Hughes, who's in the documentary. He was the bodyguard for Jackie Presser, and Jackie Presser's father was Bill Presser, and Bill Presser was in charge of the unions, you know, and basically, from my understanding, is that Cleveland is the foundation that helped build cities like Las Vegas. You know, they lended them the money to build the Stardust, the Flamingo, and the Sands Hotel, and of course, they made a fortune back on that, but really, Cleveland was always under the radar, and they liked to keep it a low profile. So the mob was always very low-key. They weren't very flamboyant. That's why you have guys, after John Scalish died, you had Jack White Nicovoli, who lived in a very, very modest house right there on the Murray Hill area, you know, and they liked to be under the radar. They weren't very flamboyant, but they were very proud of their heritage, and they were very proud of what they were able to do in their area. They were good men to their people, and if you were across them, you would actually pay the price. And that's the same thing that happened with Danny Green. He didn't really understand the mafia, and that's why he didn't understand how is there organized crime. Why do you have to ask for permission to do certain things when Danny Green just took it upon himself and just initiated all of his, you know, dealings. I mean, so they like to fly underneath the radar. And that's why I think the story was so low key, is because they didn't really want to get significance, you know, and draw attention to themselves, because it is a very important city. And it ranges back to the 1920s during the Sugarcane Wars with Rick's first book on the Lenardos and his family, the Perillos, and the fighting for the territory of the bootlegging of the sugarcane going through Lake Erie. So it just goes way, way back. But I think the Clevelanders, you know, they draw to Cleveland. They're so proud of their city, and they should be, because it was a very, very rich, important city, you know, all the way up until, like, you know, the mid, late 70s, you know, and then all of a sudden the factories started leaving the city, unfortunately. But there's a lot of rich history here, and they have a great, great pride about themselves, Clevelanders.
It really is amazing in that regard, and certainly I'm not surprised that you could come up here and find a lot of people to talk about stuff that had happened, because even in a tangential way, it seems like everybody knows somebody up here. I mean, just myself, the two things. My grandmother, who was a secretary for the Teamsters, somehow was in Danny Green's black book and got interviewed by the FBI after he got blown up. So there was that, and then I've told this on the air just because it sounds fun, but it actually happened. My grandpa on the other side of the family, he was drinking buddies with a guy named Stosh, who was a leg breaker for Shondor Burns. So, you know, all of us knew people who were connected in some way to this giant spinning web that was going on. And that's just what it was like to be up here at a point in time like that. As far as it goes for you, the follow-up that I had for you off of your initial answer was, to ask you how this grew over time. It was that tiny seed that you started with as a recent college grad, contacting Rick Perrello, going through him, starting it there. It was a long process, but by the time it was all said and done, Tommy, I mean, you had a really, really crackerjack cast for something that I guess in the technical sense is an indie movie for Hollywood, an amazing cast, and it's one of the reasons I enjoyed it so much. How did you start to piece together that tapestry over time?
You know, there's not that many original stories out there today when you come to Hollywood movies. They always want to and you're seeing it now. You're seeing a lot of remakes of old 1970s and 1980s movies that are just going through the Hollywood circle. And when you find a story like this, I knew it, there was always a vision, because I love that genre. I love the mafia. I love Godfather, Goodfellas, Casino, even Miller's Crossing, The Departed. I love that type of genre. And I knew that this story had that capabilities to be the bookshelf ending to that genre, you know, because there's not that many more original stories you can go tell. And by Danny Green, and what happened in the 1970s is a movie, and it became a movie. And when you got it into one actor's hands that was the first one to commit, which was Ray Stevenson, and he's kind of like an unknown household name, but he's a phenomenal actor. And in the movie, he looks like Danny Green, and he plays Danny Green so well. I knew that you had to support a known cast around him. And when you get guys like Christopher Walken and Val Kilmer, then the floodgates started opening. Then you got guys like Paul Sorvino, Vinnie Jones, Vinnie Vella, Vincent D'Onofrio to come in as John Nardi was the icing on the cake. Mm-hmm. And it happened because the story is good. There's not that many stories like that, and it's a true story. It's true history. And you can't just, you know, make up these stories. I couldn't even dream about making up a story where your lead actor tries to get killed 8 times and survives. It's just unbelievable. And that's why the documentary answers those questions that people might have when they see the movie. They can go right to the documentary and get all those answers that you want. And I think the documentary gives you more and tells you more of how the murder was solved of Danny Green as well. It's truly, truly remarkable. But I couldn't even dream about making up this history. It's truly remarkable that Cleveland has had this, and it was a regional story, but I knew it could be accepted on a nationwide scale because it's that blue collar, and it has such significance to what happened in organized crime, period.
And, of course, you are absolutely right, Tommy, because it does have that kind of resonance, no question. And as far as the building of the cast goes, I guess that makes sense there. Momentum builds momentum, and as one guy signs up for it, others do and everything. I love what you said about Vincent D'Onofrio, too. Before you came on, I said he's one of my favorites. And I would like to see him, while William Shatner's still in films, I'd like to see them in a scene together, just each of them trying to fill the screen on their own. That would be pretty incredible to watch. But as far as it goes with the documentary and with this thing here, the one thing I will say about the movie itself, and I vastly, vastly enjoyed it overall. There were a few things in there, particularly the scene, I won't give it away completely, the scene with the end towards the kids where, okay, I'm sitting there going, Hollywood, okay. Are things like that that basically you had to put in to kind of make it more palatable, I guess? Was it a little bit easier to do that because you were also doing the documentary and could kind of tell the unvarnished story? What were your thoughts on any of the Hollywoodization things of the movie, whether it be the timeline or other things put in for it basically for effect?
You know, that's a great question. And I wasn't the director on the movie. And
okay.
Had I been, there would have been different outcomes in certain scenes. And
gotcha.
You're right. That scene is exactly a pinpoint of what a Hollywood movie is, because in reality, that did not happen. You know, I mean, mm-hmm. Danny Green got in his car, looked at the guys who were going to murder him, which we talk about in the documentary, and there was no kids there.
Mm-hmm.
You know, but that's just like a little Hollywood touch to a movie, which, you know, I'm not going to go there, but it could have been left out. You know, we could have just got to the scene of Danny Green before he turns the key to his car, and you know what happens. But that's the part about doing Hollywood business with a big writer-director like Jonathan Hensley. So you kind of got to give up some to get some.
Sure.
And, you know, so in my eyes, it was like I'm running the ball down to the 1 yard line, and I got to lateral it to somebody else because I'm getting tackled. Mm-hmm. And I lateral the ball, hoping that guy's going to bring in the score for the touchdown. And that's what happened. Of course, you know, he might have done a little spin move to get into the end zone, which is what a Hollywood ending is like. But that's your Hollywood ending to a movie. It's always a little bit more, you know, cliche, or it's a little bit, exaggerated than it should be. So, but Jonathan did a great job with the movie. But there's some things that, you know, you can't always get what you want, and you got to sacrifice certain things to get the movie made. Again, it took me over 13 years. And after the 11th year, when I found out the movie was going to get made, it was like a dream come true. And it's funny because I shot the documentary a year before the movie got made and just sat on the footage and didn't even start editing the documentary until the movie was financed, because I had to get money to finish the documentary from an investor. And once that investor found out that the movie was getting made, he thought that, well, I can probably hedge my risk here, knowing that we could maybe piggyback on some of the hype because the documentary is the real deal. And he's absolutely right. The documentary is the real deal. And that's why I'm so excited that the Atlas Theater is going to be releasing it this weekend exclusively. And then on the following weekend, on 4/15, April 15th, we're going to go even wider and put it into 7 other theaters in the Cleveland area, from Valley View, Regal Crocker Park. And so there's a lot of other locations that are going to have the movie or the documentary next weekend. But this weekend, Atlas Theater is going to have it. And for all those people who have seen the movie that want to get that extra education on really what happened, I think they're not going to be disappointed. I know that they're going to love the documentary just as much as they do, if not more, than the movie.
I can't wait for that. And by the way, Tommy, I have to say, I mean, I really appreciate, I mean, your candor on that answer there about the Hollywoodization and everything like that. We love to explore on this show creative process with people, how these things come to be. I really appreciate the insight that you were able to give us on that and on a documentary versus a feature film and some of the decisions that you have to make. As far as it goes, and I'll be very interested to see this in the documentary here, it's been a number of years, frankly, since I've read through Mr. Perrello's book, so this isn't really coming to mind immediately, and you would be a good guy to ask about this. Watching the movie, the different things here with the Val Kilmer character and with the police, it almost, I'm not going to say that there was necessarily a bemusement, but a thing of like, hey, Danny boy, try not to kill any civilians while you guys are blowing each other up. I mean, you had the ATF in Cleveland in the summer of 76. It seemed like the feds were taking it seriously. Me as a neophyte, I don't know anything about law enforcement, but I'm sitting here going, how the hell do you have the same cast of characters successfully and unsuccessfully blowing one another up over a period of time? I mean, is there not probable cause to have gotten the net out and gotten a lot of these guys in off of the streets? And I understand that the local police are figuring, okay, maybe they're just killing each other. But what was the thought process on that with local law enforcement? The ATF was taking it seriously, and I'm not going to indict the local police by saying they weren't. But what can you tell us about the mindset and the mentality that somehow or another allowed this stuff to go on and allowed these bombs to play out as long as they did?
Well, I don't think that any of the government officials on the FBI or the police force ever allowed, you know, bombings to happen. It was just,
sure,
it was a way of major intimidation during that time period, where basically Cleveland was dubbed Bomb City USA because of the way bombs were used in Cleveland in the 1970s.
Mm-hmm.
But there are a lot, which you're going to see. I actually have exclusive photos of these bombs that were reconstructed and pictures of the actual crime scene in the documentary. And we talk about what the bombs mean, their language of, you know, what it is to intimidate. And so a lot of these bombs, sometimes they didn't even understand how to detonate them correctly, where you had bombs that had some of them gone off. Literally, the whole block of Waterloo would have gone up when Danny Green's house got blown up. But they didn't know how to correctly detonate the bomb. So I think that a lot of them, you know, they were anxious to try to get Danny Green, but they never really knew how to get him murdered. And so when you have all these cops that are involved, they want to catch you, and they want to put you away so the streets are safer for the communities, and everyone can take a breath of fresh air, you know? And now all of a sudden, you had this way of intimidating you know, jury members. You had, you know, people stop, you know, using, you know, the witness protection pro because they were so intimidating and they just didn't want to deal with it. So they just, you know, either fled the area or just was quiet after they had a bomb go off near them. They were scared. So it's a very intimidating way. But I think the police force did a great job and the FBI did a great job of coming to its fruition, solving all these murders and indicting the right people. Granted, you had a lot. I mean, James Willis is one of the best attorneys in the history of law and one of the Cleveland's finest attorneys. And he got a lot of these guys acquitted for some of their trials. And he's one of the smartest men I've ever interviewed in my life. And it's just amazing to see and hear him talk, especially in the documentary. He's so eloquent that you could see how he got a lot of these guys off and acquitted because there were errors in some of the chain of title reports that the government had. And that when you have one little crack in a case, they're going to find it. They're going to figure out a way to get this around us to stop the case from going forward. And it's just truly remarkable of what happened during that time period in Cleveland, period, because it's just an unbelievable, but yet it did happen. And it really is believable, but you think it could never happen.
Absolutely. And again, I'm glad you explained that the way that you did. And yeah, because I don't want to sound like a Monday morning quarterback here on the Cops of the Day. I'm thinking, you know, just from a neophyte perspective here, maybe there might have been a probable cause or some things where they could have pulled some guys in before things happened here. But as you said, if they couldn't make the cases stick airtight to where the lawyers couldn't get them off in the end, then I guess that really was something where it seemed like they did everything that they could. And yet, you talk about these cases where the lawyers were able to get the bombers off, or alleged bombers, I guess we have to say. But the Danny Green one is the one that stuck. And whether or not the thing at the end of the movie really told the full story or not, there were other things that really helped bring down the mob in the 80s. It was at least one of the factors in that. And that in and of itself gives it some historical significance.
Absolutely. I mean, you couldn't even try to script a story like what really happened in the time period of the 1970s in Cleveland. It was truly remarkable. And, that's who the story is resonating with, is that all the residents and people who were born from the 70s and before then, they know this history. It's so rich in Cleveland's history that I'm trying to get the younger demographics, the 20-year-olds and under, who really don't know about Danny Green, but their parents do or their grandparents do. But it's such a historical time that you really it goes out to everyone. And that's why I want everyone to go out there and see it, because it's really a part of your history of Cleveland, you know? And, like, again, I didn't make it up. I just wanted to stick with it, and I knew this would be a nationally told story because it's really incredible. I mean, what happens with the downfall of Cosa Nostra from Danny Green's death and how Danny Green took on the mafia himself, he knew, and he told his daughter this, who told me, is that he told Sharon that, like, one day they're going to make a movie on me. And I'm so thankful that I'm the guy who did it. I'm Irish and I'm Italian, and to have both those bloodlines, it's a dream for me to tell this type of story. And I'm so proud of, like, getting this story back to the people that I can't wait to get the reaction of the documentary, because it really comes through to everyone that you see the historical evidence and you hear it from three sides of the story, Rick. You hear it from the government side, you hear it from the Italian side, you hear it from the Irish side. And we have great footage, exclusive pictures that no one else has seen before that are in this documentary that makes it so great. And it's really Cleveland's documentary.
Yeah, I can't wait to see it. And as you said, it's really something that's going to resonate to a national audience as well, because of the richness of the storytelling and everything that went along with it. And as far as it goes with Danny Green, the character, who you now, as we've established, have examined, have broken down from both sides, the based on a true story side and the actual true story side. Obviously, you've gotten to go in depth with his character a lot, probably understand him as very few people have, and maybe as very few people you've ever understood by the time you got done with it. How much of this plays into our whole timeless kind of thing? You go back to fables of back in the day, Robin Hood and everything like that. It does seem to be sort of this universal archetype that we kind of keep coming back to in a compelling kind of a way in entertainment here. You know, bad guy, but he's got a good side, and, you know, he's kicking some money to the poor people, and he's, you know, not completely bad. Bandit with a heart of gold, whatever you want to call it. What is it about this guy that really strikes such a chord? Because let's face it, there was a lot of atrocities committed and a lot of blood on the guy's hands. So what draws us as a people to characters like him?
I think that he just really wanted to have a neighborhood that he resided in that was considered safe, and he really wanted to give back to his community. I think that the man, you know, from my understanding, is that everyone who was around him at that time felt protected. They felt like no one was going to do any harm to them, and they allowed them to, you know, play in the streets. And so he did have that Robin type, you know, figment to him, you know. So he's just a great guy when it comes down to a lot of the people who talked about Danny Green in that time period from that area. Now, you go on the other side and you go up towards the hill, then they're going to think a lot differently of Danny Green because of what, you know, he did to a lot of those people's families, you know. And so with respect to both sides of the story and to both families, you got to be very cognizant of, like, you know, who you're telling the story to and what you're trying to say. Because he is, you know, to a lot of people, he was very good. To a lot of people, he was horrible and evil because he hurt a lot of people's families. So, you know, you got to be cognizant of that story to each side. And that's where, you know, a good story brings in, you know, debate of, you know, was he a good person or was he a bad person? Well, what do you think, you know? And so that's where, you know, I never really wanted to stray towards one side and glorify or glamorize Danny Green by no means whatsoever, because the things that he did do were bad. And the things that, you know, he went and did to other people's families were bad, you know, and he ultimately paid the price for a lot of his, you know, actions, and that hurt a lot of his family, and their family still suffers. All the families still suffer from both sides of the story. So, you know, you got to be very respectful to the families that, you know, were hurt in this story of the 1970s. And, you know, like everyone knows, everyone has a Danny Green story, whether it's your uncle who, you know, Danny bought dog food for him or cut his hair, whatever it is. It seems like Danny Green is the Kevin Bacon of Cleveland. There's 6 degrees of separation of Danny Green in every regards in Cleveland.
Yeah, that's true. That's absolutely true. And it's a thing that's kind of gotten passed down through the generations, no question about it. It's a thing, and you're right that when you're talking to some of the families here, you know, the wounds are probably still fresh, you know, and always will be, particularly for anybody that may have died in a violent kind of a way. But it's a thing where I know, you know, the Hollywood production showed a lot of, you know, even-handedness. You saw both sides of the man. So clearly your documentary, which is going to be, I know, a stickler for all the facts of the case, certainly that will as well. Without giving away too much of the documentary, I'll just ask you to give a tease on this part of it here, because I don't want you to give too much away for the people, although I know they're still going to want to see it anyways. But that sense of fatalism towards the end, I am just curious in terms of how much embellishment there may have been in the production there versus did he get a sense that the 9 lives were gone and, you know, maybe it was going to be coming here, or did it seem to be business as usual for him?
I think that he did know that he was pushing the envelope a couple of times too many. And I really feel that, from my understanding, is that, like he told his children, you know, Sharon told me, is that he knew they were going to make a movie on him one day. Well, when you say that to someone, you know that you have a very limited amount of time left, and you just don't know when it's going to be pulled from you. So that was the part that, you know, which in the documentary, you know, you see what happens after his death. You see all the ramifications. He did accomplish something that he did not do when he was alive, but when he was dead, he did get what he always wanted to do, which was take down organized crime during that time period of Cleveland.
That's very interesting, because that was his legacy in a way, because as we indicated, it did kind of contribute to the unraveling of it, certainly as it went into the 1980s, and as the FBI and others were able to apply RICO and really kind of get to break up La Cosa Nostra a little bit more, get some of the guys to turn state's witness. So yeah, I mean, he was sort of the beginning of that in some ways. Tommy, we always love to give our guests a chance to plug here. So in addition to the two Irishman projects here that we've been talking about a lot tonight, I know you've had some other great stuff out here, whether it be Screwball, the Ted Whitfield story, 710 Split, Tag. Anything else that's on the horizon? I know you're very, very much into promoting the stuff right now with the Danny Green documentary coming out, but have you had a chance to look ahead and plot any things beyond that? If so, definitely put it out there.
Well, I'm glad that you asked that question, and yes. Well, as you know, I'm an avid sports fan, and I love all types of sports. And I have a great book that was written by a Sports Illustrated writer called All Americans, and it chronicles a story of two guys from Army and two guys from Navy that play in the 1941 football game that go from football field to battlefield. And it's basically like Saving Private Ryan meets the Pacific and Band of Brothers. It's truly a remarkable story. And you see how these gentlemen go into their journeys of World War II and learn from what they learned in the football capabilities and the skills and knowledge that they learned to survive and help others survive during that horrific World War II. And having that was a great basis where, you know, I love Cleveland. I consider it a second home. I love the history there. So I'm going to go back and I'm going to make another story, another documentary on another Cleveland criminal by the name of Phil Christopher, who was known as Super Thief, one of Rick Perlow's other books that I optioned to make a movie on too. So I want to make a movie on Rick's second book called Super Thief, as well as make a documentary on Phil Christopher. And Phil Christopher is the mastermind behind the biggest bank burglary in U.S. history that took place in Laguna Niguel, California in 1972. Truly a remarkable story. It was during that period of 1970s, again in Cleveland, which is that rich history that took place in that city, that provides all these lavish and very detailed characters, you know. And Phil Christopher is a mastermind burglar who, you know, was behind the biggest bank burglary ever. So I think that's going to be my tale, is to keep on telling these true crime documentaries and movies, and then going after the sports that I love so much. Cleveland's a great sports town. I think that they just get a bad rap at times, but they're going to come back. Every city loves a comeback. They're going to get their due here very soon. You just got to get that one athlete that takes them to a championship and whatever it's going to be, and they're close. They're going to get there. I think that you guys are right on the cusp of getting a major star athlete to come right in there and bring it on board. But, you know, with All Americans and Super Thief, I got some good projects lined up for the horizon, and I'm just excited to have everyone go out to Atlas Theater this weekend in Euclid to go see the Danny Green documentary.
Well, I can't wait to see it myself, Tommy. And yeah, as you indicated, you talked before about Kevin Bacon, 1970s Cleveland. Yeah, it's almost the Kevin Bacon 6 degrees of great storytelling. It seems like it all ties back to that. And, you know, in a more facetious sense here, maybe this is 20 degrees of separation, but I felt like coming in tonight, we had at least a tangential connection to you, in as much as one of your sister Tara's great movies, Van Wilder, Ryan Reynolds was in that. One of the guys on our crew for this show here is a complete Ryan Reynolds doppelganger. So I don't know if that's 20 right or 30 on degrees of separation, Tommy.
Well, that's great. That's awesome.
Well, I was really looking forward to having you on, and really lived up the expectations, Tommy. I can't wait to see this movie, and it would be our privilege to have you back on sometime to continue talking about your projects.
I really appreciate the time. Thank you guys so much for having me on your show. and wishing you guys all the best, and thanks so much for your time.
It's our pleasure, Tommy. Thank you so much. All right. Hollywood producer and director Tommy Reed, everyone. It's a pleasure to have him on the program here tonight. You definitely want to check out the movies in theaters here. I'm unsure of what the national distribution schedule is going to be on these. I think Kill the Irishman, which is the Hollywood slash indie version of this, the slightly fictionalized version of the Tommy Green story, that I believe is in quasi-national release right now. And then the documentary, which is coming out, Danny Green, The Rise and Fall of the Irishman. We do know that it's going to be in decent release here in the Sports Talk Network flagship city of Cleveland. I think there will be some distribution nationally after that. Certainly both will be available on DVD regardless of that in the near future. But I think you can probably catch them both in the theaters depending on which markets you live in right now. I can tell you from personal experience, the indie version of it was a great one. The documentary, I'm sure, is going to be as well. Can't wait to see it once it's released.